Hi, I'm Sam Cedar. This week on Ring of Fire, David Dayen will join me to discuss his latest piece in the American Prospect, The Winter of Our Discontent, which explores what could happen in the 78 days left of Donald Trump's presidency after the November election. Heather Digby Parton will help me run down some of the big news stories of the week. Listen, if you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us both a favor. Support the program. You can help us out and help yourself out by becoming a member at ROFpodcast.com. It is your support that keeps this show going. Here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and, of course, her Uber blog, Hullabaloo. So, Heather, we are now less than 2 months from the, the day that they start counting the ballots. I want to call it Election Day. It is the day that people are going. We are less than 2 months away from the last day that you can cast your ballot. Let's put it that way, because we really have no sense of when this will be resolved. But that's for another talk. We are very close to the election. We are on the other side of Labor Day now, and I should say I hope you had a happy Labor Day. And the implications of that are big, and we will talk about that when we start talking about a little bit more about the campaign, because you know we have entered into a period where 6 months ago, we would have said Donald Trump is having a bad day. Let's hope he has a nervous breakdown and resigns. That's not happening. But we are now, because there's such a limited amount of time before the election, some of the stories that have broken this week actually have material implications on the election that they wouldn't have had, let's say, 6 to 8 months ago, maybe. But before we get there, let's talk about some of the reasons why it's so important to get Donald Trump out of office. There's a multitude of those, but there's a couple of stories this week that I think really make that deal with one aspect of it, and that is they told us this within the first 6 months. Steve Bannon got up there and said, you know, one of our agendas is to destroy the administrative state. And we see this in a couple of agencies. I'm talking just about the DOJ and the DHS this week. We have two different stories that show how corrupted they have become in terms of what their purpose is.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there were several things that happened along those lines, any one of which would have been a huge story, except that we're so overwhelmed right now with so much, and not just campaign stuff. I mean, this is unusual because usually you think, you know, in this kind of campaign season is who committed a gaffe or, you know, whatever. That isn't what's happening at the moment, at least not this week. And so these stories that are huge in and of themselves were sort of, you know, just sort of part of the churn. But it's important to sort of talk about this a little bit because it's astonishing. I'll start with the Department of Justice. Bill Barr basically, I'm sure everybody recalls that, you know, a few months ago, there was a story was revealed by a writer by the name of E. Jean Carroll, who claimed that Trump had attempted to rape her in a dressing room about 25 years ago.
In like Macy's or something, right.
And, you know, she's a writer. She had put it in her book, and it became, you know, was quite a lurid, pretty awful story. And she has sued Trump for defamation because he said he didn't know her, and I think he said, she's not my type. She's not somebody, you know, she's not the kind of gal I'd rape, you know, if I... I rape
right.
other kinds of girls who look different or something. I mean, that seemed to be his implication. In any case, she sued him, and that lawsuit has been going forward. And suddenly this week, the Department of Justice jumped into it and has made a pleading to take the case, put it into federal court under this kind of obscure law that says that people in the employ of the federal government that they are protected from these sorts of lawsuits, and in other words, they can only be dealt with in federal court, and the Department of Justice will, it's supposed to be done in the course of their jobs, right? I mean, that's something like
right.
defamation.
I mean, there's two elements. One is that they need to work for a federal agency. They need to be an employee of a federal agency. And the second element of it is that the defamation, they are immune if the defamation took place in the course of their duties, if they were acting in their governmental capacity, in the capacity of that job, in this defamation. And that's what they contend. And that's why they justify the DOJ taking over from his private defense attorneys.
And I mean, and just think about this. I mean, this is completely outrageous. This was a private, matter that took place 25 years ago, long before Trump was in office. And Trump, you know, made this public statement that she is claiming defamed her. And that had nothing to do with his job. I mean, he was out there just saying this. It's completely, it was a personal thing between him and her and the public, but it had nothing to do with his job. And, it seems obvious to me that this is going nowhere. They get one of these right-wing Trump judges and maybe somehow or another it finds its way into the federal court. But the reality of this is, I think, and I mean, you'd tell me if you think I'm wrong, I'm seeing a lot of stuff happening along those lines. And with Barr in particular, what you're seeing with the Department of Justice is this is about timing. It suggests to me what was happening in the state court was that this case was proceeding, and the judges were saying, okay, we need discovery. And they were going to go, like she was asking for DNA from Trump, and they wanted to get him to give a deposition, that sort of thing. That Bill Barr took this case, perhaps for some philosophical reason about the unitary executive, I don't know, trying to prove something out that a president can't be sued at all for anything ever. That seems to be part of his belief system. But it's also because they wanted to delay this case until after the election. And so Barr is, actively working on behalf of Trump to help him get elected by manipulating the Department of Justice to make that happen. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen anything like this before. I mean, this is just one of many things. I mean, you're talking about, getting the Roger Stone matter off the docket. Trump ended up commuting his sentence, but all of this stuff that's been going on, trying to fire the Southern District of New York U.S.
attorney.
Yeah, going through all of this kind of stuff. I mean, this is all in service of Trump and the election. I mean, it's clear. And I have no doubt that this Durham report, Barr made it clear that he does not believe that Durham report has anything to do with this Department of Justice policy that says you can't interfere in an election 60 days before. And Barr's interview with Wolf Blitzer, he made it clear that he doesn't think that this applies. So he's probably going to drop that at some, moment, propitious moment for Trump in the campaign. So they are blatant. I mean, I'm not saying the Department of Justice isn't political or that it hasn't been. I mean, we went through the U.S. attorney scandal during the Bush administration where they were using have the U.S. attorneys, voter fraud investigations, right?
And a bunch of them quit.
Because of it.
Yeah, well, I mean, they did the voter fraud investigations. They ended up pressuring them to bring charges where there was none. That was part of the problem.
Where there were none, yeah. It was even worse. And that ended up with, Alberto Gonzalez, the attorney general at the time, resigned over that. I mean, that was a big, big scandal. So, I mean, I'm not suggesting that nobody's ever done any political thing with the Department of Justice before, but this is really beyond the pale, what Bill Barr is doing. And then, so there's that that's happening, and that's just happening in plain sight, and we're all watching it and going, boy, that Bill Barr. The next thing that's happening is the Department of Homeland Security. You've got this guy, Chad Wolf, who's the acting director, and then his top lieutenant, who's Ken Cuccinelli. They used to call him the Cooch. He was lieutenant governor of Virginia, and he is a right-wing extremist fanatic. And, in fact, they knew they couldn't get him through the Senate, even with the Republican Senate. So, you know, they put him in an acting capacity as well. I mean, none of these people have actually been confirmed because they can't be, you know, that they can't withstand any kind of public scrutiny. In any case,
we should also say, just to add to that, forgive me for interrupting, but the Government Accountability Office said, on top of the fact that they're only acting, that they are actually not legal. Their appointment as acting DHS is not legit. And in fact, because there is a succession rule, right, that you cannot fire these people and then just bring in random people to avoid Senate confirmation, they actually have to be next in command within the context of the DHS, and neither one of those guys were. And so the Government Accountability Office said, actually, they're serving illegally as it is. But of course, there's very little recourse for that, as we have found out in a myriad of different ways, that a lot of our the laws and the sort of like democratic principles of our government are nice, but not necessarily enforceable. But go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, and again, you know, that's part of the problem, because you have people like this guy Chad Wolf, and you have this Ken Cuccinelli, both of whom are Trump henchmen. I mean, this is their you know, identity within the government. This is who they are. They're like, Bill Barr is one too. They're not there as, you know, career professionals or law enforcement professionals, or, you know, they're just there to follow Trump's bidding. And what they've been doing, and this is becoming revealed in a couple of ways. There was somebody provided one of the news organizations, I think it was NBC, with some documents showing that the recent reporting within the DHS, that they do studies, and, you know, they risk assessments, said that the greatest domestic risk was from white supremacists. And what this whistleblower or the leaker, whoever, who gave it to the news organization, showed was all these successive drafts that they had done the assessment, they did the analysis, based upon, you know, all their investigations and what have you, and it kept coming back that you got to change this. You need to change this because, and it's pretty clear that it's because, you know, they don't want to show this white supremacy being the top risk for domestic terrorism, which is essentially what this was saying. So it makes its way to the top, and then they send it back and say, no, we can't say this, we can't say this. Now, this sort of, you know, goes back to something I read a couple weeks ago about Trump. I think it was in the Daily Beast. They said he's triggered by any discussion of domestic terrorism or Russian interference in the election. So they can't bring this up to him. It's like if he sees this, he gets very upset. So it's that they've been tailoring reports and tailoring intelligence and tailoring risk assessments around this guy's, you know, his own, you know, psychopathy. And that brings up the other DHS. There was a whistleblower that came out on the same day that the Woodward book, which came out this week, or the previews of the Woodward book came out this week. And this is a whistleblower in the Department of Homeland Security saying that they basically, he named Chad Wolf, he named Kirstjen Nielsen, he named a whole bunch of people, sort of, you know, saying that, A, they lied to Congress and about a number of things, including the family separations and a lot of the immigration stuff that went on under Nielsen's reign when she was the director. And then more recently, this ongoing battle over the Russian, Russian interference. And, I mean, this is a big, big issue that, you know, we are finding that throughout the government, you've got people that, you know, Trump henchmen pushing back on any suggestion that there is Russian interference happening now happening in the future. Bill Barr went on Wolf Blitzer a week ago. He said that he doesn't believe that the Russian interference, he says, well, they might interfere, but we know they already are. And the whole idea here was to shift the concern about interference onto China. And that, and they were demanding, this whistleblower says they were demanding that they shift the rhetoric and all of the sort of public talking points to saying that China was the one that was the big risk. And this is, of course, again, playing into Trump's campaign, his campaign talking points. So, I mean, we're seeing some stuff here that is just, it's mind-boggling, and there's so much churn going on that it's really hard to focus and figure out exactly, I mean, not that we can do anything about it at the moment, but it's just, it's kind of hard to wrap your mind around the full extent of the corruption of the government under Donald Trump to benefit Donald Trump personally and in his reelection.
And we've seen this before, right? You know, when Barack Obama came in, there were you had 8 years of George Bush, and right wingers who had basically become embedded in some of these agencies, and it really, you know, the fact is, and I don't think this is, you know, I don't think this is a partisan statement. I think it's simply, you know, an objective stating that I would think that most conservatives wouldn't disagree with. I mean, like I said, Steve Bannon, you know, announced the CPAC. What we're going to do is deconstruct the administrative state. All of these agencies become degraded. They become degraded because you've demoralized a lot of the career people. You have fired a lot of the career people. You have prevented them from moving up. These are people who work for these agencies, who perceive themselves as nonpartisan, and, you know, they do the functioning of these agencies. But when you look at the assault that the Trump administration has done on these agencies, I think it's probably, you know, except for the time, and time is an important factor, right? Because if you have 8 years of this, there are generations of people who are just not going to follow that career path because they know they can't get into that agency. But when you look at, like, what's been done to the EPA, what's been done to DHS, what's been done to the Department of Justice, and FDA, actually, and the OSHA and
and
labor.
CDC.
And CDC. It is going to take a long time to rebuild these agencies into functioning agencies again and, raise morale and get procedures back on track and to have them function. And that's assuming that Joe Biden wins the election, which I knock on wood. But and certainly this week, I think, is going to help. In terms of helping Joe Biden, Donald Trump had, I think, by really any reckoning, a bad week this week in regards to his election. And, you know, unlike us saying this in January of 2018 or even January of 2020, for that matter, there is a limited amount of time between now and the election. In fact, in many places, absentee balloting has already started. And there is a limited amount of time for Donald Trump to do what he needs to do to beat Joe Biden. Now, that's leaving aside the very real potential, and I, you know, one that I think really scares me. I'm going to talk to David Dayen about it on this program this week, about the potential for a huge cluster F, if you will, in the context of the election. But in terms of, like, just if this was just going to be a normal election, Donald Trump, his number one objective is to damage Joe Biden and to depress Joe Biden's get out the vote efforts. Because I think everybody knows, I think most Republicans would concede this too, Donald Trump will not win the majority of votes in this country. He may lose by 1 million votes. He may lose by 3 million like he did in 2016. He could lose by 10 million votes. The real question is, can he depress turnout for Biden enough in some very key states to win the Electoral College? Remember, Donald Trump won the 2016 election
with less votes than Mitt Romney had when he lost the 2012 election. And so the key for Donald Trump is to make sure that Joe Biden gets less votes than a Democrat normally would. Let's put it that way. And he needs to be able to go and land punches on Joe Biden, but he can't do that, and he can't launch punches if he is defending himself against what, you know, two major things that have happened over the course of the past week, week and a half, which is that there was a story claiming that he, and with other confirmations, that he basically said that military personnel who died in combat were losers and suckers, and that he did not go to visit a cemetery back in 2018 where there are many dead U.S. Marines who died in World War I, a very famous battle in the Marine Corps anyways. You know, it's the one where they basically, you know, coined all the sayings that Marines have, like, you know, give them hell and we're not going to stop fighting type of jingoism. And where the Marines, I think they lost 60% of the men in that who were fighting in that battle. And he basically said, I'm not going to go to those, you know, that they're a bunch of losers. They're all buried there. Why would I want to go and do that? And I think he was worried about messing up his hair. And then, of course, this story that dropped with the tapes of Bob Woodward, where Donald Trump basically said, yeah, no, COVID is really bad. It's much worse than the flu, et cetera, but I like to downplay it. And he said this in early February of this year. And so these are two really, I think, potentially damaging revelations. I mean, where are you on that?
I agree with you. I think they are potentially damaging. You would assume in a sane world that they'd be extremely damaging,
right.
And there would be no doubt about it. But we know, as we've gone through this whole Trump era, that, you know, you never know what's going to land with him and what isn't. And, you know, the losers and suckers story is very interesting to me because I think that people have misinterpreted Trump on this for a long time. You know, I have thought from the very beginning and following him through the 2016 campaign, his objection to forever wars, which I think a lot of people sort of want to give him some credit for, and I would, you know, it's stop the clock, you know, is right twice a day, right? So, you know, and he's not wrong about 100% of everything. So, you know, I think a lot of us believe that the forever wars are a very bad idea and they need to be ended in some way. But Trump's objection to them is not because he thinks, you know, he feels bad that, you know, people's lives are being lost or even that money's being spent, although that's a big part of what he cares about, well, it's like everything to him and it's how much, what's the bill, you know. But the reason that he is upset about these wars, or aside from the fact that he objects to anything his predecessors did, and why I don't believe he would think twice about starting another war under certain circumstances, is because the reason that he doesn't like them is because he considers them loser wars. And loser war meaning that they, you know, America doesn't know how to win. We need to win wars. This is why he doesn't like them. And so, you know, when those Marines, 60% of them were killed on the battlefield, he thinks that's stupid because they, you know, they're losers. He thinks, you know, this is a guy who pardoned war criminals, who talked about torture over and over and over again as a positive thing, who believes in summary executions of prisoners. I mean, what he doesn't understand, and this comes through in the Woodward book too, at least I haven't read it, of course, not out yet, but from the excerpts that I've seen, is that, you know, he thinks that he has said to the generals, another book that came out got called A Very Stable Genius by Washington Post reporters Phil Rucker and Carol Lenning, has a big anecdote in it where he is called called in, the generals are really worried because Trump is so ignorant about national security and American history and America's place in the world. They had to do this tutorial. And he got very, very angry. He didn't like it. And he says, you know, you're all a bunch of losers. He said, you don't know how to win anymore. So, you know, what Trump believes in is that America should have this gigantic military, which, by the way, he has certainly been bragging about. So whatever comments he may make about the military-industrial complex are a little hollow from the guy who spent right. trillions on the military-industrial complex. But nonetheless, when he says this stuff, you know, his buildup of the military, what he believes in is all-out winning by any means necessary, and that he said it back in the campaign in 2016, I'd bomb the shit out of him. You know, I mean, this is his thing. And so I think people misunderstand him. He is not a pacifist. He's not an isolationist. He's not a mind your own business, don't get involved kind of thing. He cannot stand the fact that the American military lives under a certain, you know, rules of war and laws of war, and that the world is sort of organized around this, even NATO and all of that stuff. His objection is visceral in the idea that if we're going to fight, I'm going to win, you know, he'll use the bomb. I mean, I just don't think there's any right. doubt about it, that he believes in that, in using this. He was even bragging in the Woodward book about how, well, we've got this really great new system, this big new system. I mean, you know, Xi and Putin, they don't even know anything about it. So naturally, he, you know, tells it to a reporter. But in any case, I just think that a lot of that, and so this loser thing, I think on some level, I'm not sure that people really see it exactly the same way I do, but there is this idea that he sees the military as a bunch of losers because they, you know, they don't know how to win. And, you know, that is dangerous for him because that is one of the very basic fundamental, you know, foundations of the Republican base.
Party.
I mean, you know, it's huge. So if they and there had already been polling, and I think it's one of the reasons why Trump panicked as much as he did about it. There was already polling showing that there were more people voting for more military voting for Biden than for him in this, and that was kind of shocking results because, you know, that just never happens. I mean, so only 16% of the military identify themselves as Democrats. So, I mean, that should tell you something. In any case, I think that is a big story. And of course, you know, the Woodward thing, the pandemic is the issue in the election. It is in every poll. The pandemic is number one. He is on the line for his response. And that those tapes, I mean, it's not so much the book. I mean, books are books. You know, you get quotes. Woodward taped him, and his voice is there. And when
yes.
he said that, you know, hearing him say it. And I want to ask you something about this. I've been curious to see what you think. We've been going round and round, I think, from the very beginning of Trump being on the scene. Is he just plain stupid?
Yes.
Or
you know what?
Malevolent?
I know what you're going to ask me, and I had this thought today, actually, when I was listening to it. But go ahead. I know where you're going with
this.
Tell me. Like, a lot of people are like, is this really a surprise? We all knew he said this and this and that. But in the past, when he said these things about COVID, I think my belief was this guy's just out of his mind. And he, you know, some right-wing troll tells him something that he reads on Gateway Pundit or, you know, on InfoWars or whatever it is, and he believes it. But this really shows that he made a very cold and calculated had a cold and calculated strategy that you hear him saying in the first week of February, I just got off the phone with Xi. This is five times more dangerous. This is much more deadly than the flu. It's a lot trickier because it's airborne. It's not touched, right? And you think about all the misinformation we got. We got a misinformation from every level of government. But the president clearly knew this was not about, you know, stuff that you can touch on a surface. This is about being airborne. And I'll tell you something. In February, that was not widely known.
Absolutely.
And he knew it. He knew it enough to say it to Woodward. And he spells it out. I mean,
And he said, I like to play it down because I don't want there to be a panic. And I'll tell you, what is he talking about is the panic? Now, we've all said this, right? Speculation. He was obsessed about the stock market and this and that. But to hear him say it is really stunning. The panic he's talking about is the stock market.
Of course.
That's it. Period. End of story. He's talking about a sell-off panic. He's not, because there is no, like, it's not like, you know, I can understand it. Like, we're on a boat. The boat is sinking. I don't want people to panic because they're going to rush the doors and nobody's going to get out. Or, you know, we're in a theater. I don't want anybody to know that there's a bomb in here because we want people to orderly leave the theater. You know, we don't want them all rushing out or nobody's going to get out alive. What does panic look like in the context of a pandemic that you think is about to hit? The panic looks like people getting masks, people trying to stay away from each other. The panic looks like exactly like you want people to behave. There is no panic that can sort of run counter to what people's behavior should be. Wear scarves around your face. Don't breathe on people. And the panic he's talking about is the stock market. Now, my sense is, and like, I don't know if this could change a single vote for Donald Trump. And the reason why I think the timing of this is the only thing that really has a chance to have a material effect. Because it's possible that some of Trump voters or would-be Trump voters or, you know, people who don't engage hear this and they go, wow, this guy's bad at his job. I'm not going to vote for him. It's possible that will happen. But more importantly, he's worried that that's what's going to happen. There are a limited amount of days. You know, look, Joe Biden is out there, and I don't know if you've watched some of his speeches. Like, he's doing gaffes left and right. And you don't hear about it because there's far more important news. And, you know, contrary to 2016, where, and somebody did a graphic I saw on Twitter, you know, this is when it was revealed about her emails on the front page of the New York Times. And this is, the Comey letter or something. And this is where it was revealed that Donald Trump said, it was revealed that he knew exactly what we were dealing with in terms of COVID and downplayed it. And the Times, you know, understated the latter situation and overstated the former. But nevertheless, Joe Biden's not on that page.
No.
And every day that Joe Biden doesn't make news is a day that Donald Trump cannot get back to convince people to not vote for Joe Biden. That's the dynamic of this election. I've had many people tell me, people who work on these campaigns and whatnot, what we were seeing with the polling was like was basically, you know, as if you threw two anvils off of a building. And it was really just a question of which one was going to land first. And the other one was going to be the one who wins the election. They were both, you know, both Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were very disliked candidates. And it was really just a question of who was going to be more disliked on that day that people went to vote. And the dynamic is very different this time. And every day that Donald Trump has to defend himself against his own behavior, essentially, and his sense that, like, this could undercut me with my voters, is a day that he cannot make Joe Biden less likable to voters who are just sick of Donald Trump.
That's absolutely right. And it's interesting because all the stuff that's, you know, they're doing a lot of polling now. And so there's a lot of analysis going on about all of that. And the two anvil thing is really an interesting way of putting it. Because I remember reading about the 2016, it's exactly as you say, in that the poll was going back and forth. You know, it was a constant thing. There'd be some disastrous email dump, you know, some disastrous WikiLeaks dump, and Hillary would, you know, fall off, then beat Comey, then there was the Access Hollywood, you know, and all this stuff. it was going back and forth. Now, everybody was so complacent, thinking, look, this freak cannot win, right? I mean, come on, you know, of course.
Right.
Trump isn't going to win. People were sort of watching that without, you know, getting any sense that, wow, this is really, you know, this could go either way. That just wasn't the way people perceived it. And interestingly, now I think there's a lot more sense of panic about, you know, oh my God, you know, what if he wins? But the polling, the analysis that they're doing, this has been the most stable polling in presidential history. It just, you know, nothing really seems to hit it. And so that is what you're describing, this Trump's absolute necessity to do something to Joe Biden. I mean, I suppose he's thinking that the debates are going to be the big moment where he's really going to put Biden in his place. But he's not preparing for the debates, by the way. That came out this week. He's going to wing it because he's been preparing for these debates his whole life, he says. So he's not going to do any preparation. So he's just going to, you know, run his game, do his thing. But that, you know, this, he has to do something to get people to put that anvil around Joe Biden's neck. It's just not there, you know. And the
right.
one around his own neck is really, really heavy and getting heavier. And, you know, I mean, look, I mean, I've said this a million times. I'm sure you've said it on your shows a million times. There's always 40% of the American public who will vote Republican.
Without a doubt.
That goes all the way back to Herbert Hoover. You know, I mean, 39.7% voted for Herbert Hoover in the biggest landslide in American history for Franklin Delano Roosevelt in 1932. Ronald Reagan in 84, huge landslide, gigantic electoral college win. 40% of the people voted for Mondale. You know, this is how this works. I mean, there's always going to be that base. So any expectation that somehow or another the dynamics are going to change so dramatically that, you know, Biden will win in this gigantic runaway, you know, train that Trump's voters are all going to desert him at the last minute.
Right. No way.
That's not going to happen. And, you know, it wouldn't happen no matter who it was. I mean, you might think it should happen with him. But at this point, it seems to me that these kinds of things, the Woodward book is very interesting. For me, personally, I think it's mostly because of the tapes. Having tapes makes all the difference. You can
all the difference in the world.
Talking.
Hearing him say that really, really, really struck me. And I've spent 4 years just, you know, talking about how horrific he is.
Now, I was struck by, and this goes back to the original thing we were talking about, by how almost normal he sounds on those tapes, the way he's talking. I mean, this has raised a bunch of questions in me about my interpretation of Donald Trump, I have to say, just by listening to those tapes and hearing what he was saying. I didn't know if he could understand what was going on with the pandemic, and I kind of assumed he didn't get it, you know, that he was just, you know, it's just too much for him. He's an idiot. And I'm not going to change my mind about him being some kind of secret, you know, genius or anything. But it does tell me that he heard what people were saying. He understood what was going on.
He totally understood it.
And I agree with you that this was a very cold, calculated decision based upon, I agree with you also about the stock market. You know, stock market panic is an actual term, right?
And yes, exactly.
When he said panic, I mean, it wasn't just sort of a word he plucked out of nowhere.
Well, that's my point, is that when he says panic, he's referring to the stock market. It is
a panic
sell-off.
And remember, we had one.
Yep. Panic sell-off.
And he signed when the ticker went back up. He signed the ticker with his name and sent it around to people. I mean, it was like that was just a crazy time. And of course, we know that just from his public statements that he's been obsessed with the economy. This is what he cared about in the pandemic. But there was another thing that had been reported that I've sort of, you know, put into my pieces more than once, was that there was a moment when he was sitting there. And they had one of those when he used to attend the coronavirus briefings. It was pretty early on, and he said, "Why can't we just let it wash over the whole country? Why can't we just let it wash over the whole country? In other words, you know, the herd immunity thing, although
right.
he didn't use those words. And Fauci, and this must have been told by him, I think, he looked at him like, you know, wait, what are you talking about? And he said, yeah, just let it wash over the whole country. And Fauci said, well, if we do that, you know,
2 million
the
people
of
will die.
Deaths will be, you know, horrendous. We can't do it. And Trump's like, well, okay. That tells me that's what he always thought. It was just,
yep.
you know, who cares? Let it happen. Open up. And from that point on, he was agitating, just get the economy, you know, put people back at work, get them back. We don't care. You know, whatever happens, happens. And, you know, that's his attitude now. It is what it is. 190,000 people, probably 250,000 people by the end of the year, you know, I mean, or maybe more. I mean, that's just his attitude. And so, you know, he knew. It wasn't that he was too stupid to understand what this meant. He understood it from the very beginning. And he actually, you know, he sounded, you know, like he was pretty much in control there. And that surprised me.
I agree with that totally. Lastly, let's just we just got a couple of minutes here. There was an interesting focus, a piece by Stanley Greenberg in The Prospect, who is a Democratic pollster, and he was looking at some focused groups in suburbs of Michigan, in some rural areas in Wisconsin, in Ohio, and some suburbs in Florida, I think. And he said it dovetailed with some of the polling he's seeing that healthcare is a huge issue. And I think, you know, this piece I found was a really interesting dynamic, because a lot of these people basically said, we wanted somebody to come in and do something about health care. And Donald Trump said he was going to. That people were fed up with high premiums and whatnot. And, you know, these are people who didn't get expanded Medicaid. But also we're dealing with the broken insurance system that we have.
Mm-hmm.
And Donald Trump, all he had to do was come in and say, I'm going to fix it. You know, these are not policy wonks. You know, people don't have the ability to say, like, well, this is going to work, this marketplace, blah, blah, blah. They just wait and see. You know, somebody who talks about it and is willing to come in and say, we need radical change, I'm going to give you something different, was sufficient for them. Well, Donald Trump failed in their minds. And he did. I mean, he did absolutely nothing except for maybe degrade the Affordable Care Act. But he certainly didn't help anything. And these same people in the focus group are like, you know, Joe Biden doesn't seem to be offering anything in that regard in terms of health care. And it's true. I think, you know, Joe Biden is offering small bore stuff in terms of health care. It's not even as ambitious as Hillary Clinton's plan was in terms of health care. But it feels like this is going to be the dynamic, and I think it's going to cut in the Democrats' favor. 2018, they talked a lot about health care going into that election. I think there was two types of voters. Voters who want to come out and say, I don't like Donald Trump. This is a referendum on Donald Trump. And then voters who said, like, I want health care. I want better health care situation. And I think the Democrats did well in that environment. I think they're going to do well in this environment, despite the fact that Joe Biden's not offering something. He's talking a little bit about health care, and that, you know, people are dissatisfied with Donald Trump. The problem is going to be in 2022 and in 2024 that if the Democrats do not step up and do something meaningful on the health care front, public option for Obamacare will not affect 80%, 90% of the people in this country who have private health insurance. That public option is only available to about 10, 12 million people in the exchanges. And so they've got to step up and start thinking about this. Maybe it's premature now because all that they're focused on is the election. But I look at that thing that Nancy Pelosi suggested in terms of the HEROES Act, which is subsidizing COBRA because she's so allergic to expanding health insurance in any fashion whatsoever. And nothing is less efficient than subsidizing COBRA. Nothing. Period. End of story. There is no more expensive insurance product, particularly dollar for dollar, than the idea of COBRA insurance.
Right.
And Democrats, you know, the Democrats better figure this out, because otherwise we're going to be right back here in 2022. We're going to be right back here in 2024. And that's presuming that the Joe Biden wins. And, you know, I think that his lack of talking about health care is a liability, and but hopefully is not going to be one that is going to dominate. Heather, we will have more to talk about, I am sure, a week from now, as we will be 1 week closer to the election. And it is all hands on deck time. I want to encourage people to go out, vote. If you can vote in person, absent, you know, early voting, go do that. If you want to vote absentee and put it in the mail, go do that. But if you can make it to the and physically put your ballot in there, that is going to help. You know, maybe next week we will touch on what we could be looking at on what we call Election Day. But in fact, will not resolve anything in my mind. Digby, always a pleasure.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sam.
What could happen in the 78 days following the November 3rd election? Well, hold on to your seats or your hats or sit down, folks, because here to tell us what's been keeping him up at night, David Dayen from the American Prospect. So, David, you write in the Prospect this week, I guess, the winter of our discontent, projecting the 78 harrowing days after the election. Let's start on, let's do 79 days. Let's do the day of the election as well, because okay. And start there, because I have become increasingly worried about that election day that we have called it in the past, but in many respects it's really just the last day in which you can vote. And then every day from there, give us a sense of what your, you know, where we start with this concern. And I guess it starts with like day 78 out from, or 79 out from the inauguration.
Yeah. So, you know, I got really concerned. I don't think people have an appreciation for everything that can and maybe will go wrong within the country from Election Day onward. And it's not just election-based. It's even if the election is relatively tranquil, although I can't see that happening.
Right.
Even if it's tranquil, the transition is going to be filled with really problematic situations. We've seen bad transitions throughout history. In 1860, seven states seceded from the Union during the Buchanan-Lincoln transition. In 1876, we didn't know who the president was going to be until 2 days before Election Day, because there was a separate commission deciding who won particular states in the race between Rutherford B. Hayes and Samuel Tilden. In 1932, Hoover refused to cooperate at any level with Franklin Roosevelt, wanted to only engage in measures that would aid the economy if Roosevelt gave up on the New Deal. And that was seen as such a horrible transition that there was an act of Congress and a constitutional amendment to change Inauguration Day to actually shrink the size of the transition. And I see this transition as all of those things in at once, including the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic. So you put four of those things together, and that's the stew in which we'll be marinating between Election Day and January 20th. And we can get into some of the details, but that's the great concern that I have, that people are not prepared for what's to come. They've thought that the last 4 years of Trump in the White House has been this concussive experience that has created this whiplash among the population. But it's going to get worse in this interregnum period.
And you know, this is all premised on the idea that, that Joe Biden wins, obviously.
Well, it's win or lose. I mean, win, lose, or Trump says he wins. I mean, there's going to be problems.
Well, even, without a doubt.
Even if it's a good outcome necessary in terms of the you know, repairing of democracy, in terms of there being a peaceful transfer of power. Even in that scenario, there's going to be a really tough stuff happening.
All right. Well, let's do a little bit of speculating, and let's start with November 3rd. That is Election Day.
Right.
What we're going to have by the end of the day is we're going to have results coming in from some states. But the states that are going to be really in play in many respects, the ones that are going to be the most important, the ones that are on the sort of the precipice, as it were, it is very likely that mail-in ballots will cause these states to report their results the next day, 2 days later, 3 days later, mm-hmm. 4 days later, 5 days later, a week later. Now, you and I remember 2000, right? Some of our listeners probably don't. Some many do. But that went on for a month and a half, at least, I think it was. I think it didn't get resolved until mid-December, December 20th or somewhere around there.
And that was one state, right?
And that was one state. And one thing that people, I want to remind people of, the so-called Brooks Brothers riot, which involved Republican staffers and Republican lawyers, including John Roberts at the time, dressed in, you know, they, I don't know if they were all wearing Brooks Brothers clothes, but they were dressed like, you know, like lawyers and businessmen.
Business casual. Business casual.
And they pounded on the doors of the counting
County,
that was going
Miami
on
did,
in Palm
yeah.
Beach.
Yeah.
And they stopped the counting. Now, that to me is a model for what we could see happen in some county in Michigan, some county in Wisconsin, some county in Pennsylvania, maybe some county in Arizona. In fact, I would imagine, and maybe, this is just, we're in projection territory here, and I want to just get your take on this, that the Republicans, and one could hope the Democrats, but at the very least that the Republicans are looking at, like, this is where the election's going to come down. There's 15 counties around the country, let's say, and the election's going to come down to these 15 counties. And when they deploy people, it's not necessarily, they're not necessarily deploying lawyers this time. They have street thugs. Maybe it's the Proud Boys. Maybe it's Patriot Prayers. Maybe it's, you know, whatever it is. And it's conceivable to me that we could see some version of this where they're like, you guys are just digging for votes, you know, when in fact what's going on is they're just counting absentee ballots. I mean, we heard Paul Ryan say there was something suspicious going on in California. There's no reason to believe that we're not going to see echoes of this, but it's going to be potentially violent, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think the Brooks Brothers riot is a tea party compared to what we might be able to see this time around. The Republicans have, as you said, road tested this. In 2016, even with Donald Trump saying he actually won the popular vote because there were 3 million illegals who voted. In 2018, when you had the blue shift where late counted absentees, were determinative in several races in California and in the Arizona Senate race, at a moment where it looked like there was a shift happening in the Florida governor's race, Trump said, they should take the election night count, that they should stop counting. They shouldn't do that anymore. And in none of these situations was he on the ballot, right? So there are several states. One thing that I think people don't realize is several of the battleground states, Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, by current law, you're not allowed to open absentee ballots until after the election day closes. So those votes cannot be counted until the election night begins, which means that, and it just takes a long time to count absentee ballots. I mean, you have to in some states, verify signatures, verify matching signatures. You have to, you know, the mechanical process of opening up hundreds of thousands of ballots, putting them through a scanning machine. All the things that happen in real time on election day have to happen all at once after the election. And we know that, and according to polling, Democrats are more interested in mail-in voting than Republicans are. So there are going to be more Democratic votes in that bushel of mail-in votes that isn't going to be counted until later on in the process. And so there is a strong likelihood that Trump will be ahead in key states, but the race will be too close to call. And you could see this shift, this blue shift that we saw in other states in 2018. And think about Donald Trump and what he has been doing to delegitimize mail-in voting throughout this entire election. If he is ahead on election night in Pennsylvania and votes start coming in and that lead starts to shrink, he's going to say that these are fraudulent votes. I mean, he's telling it to you very clearly, weeks and weeks out from this election. He's going to say that the election has been stolen. We know that there are substantial numbers of people who believe anything he says, and we know that there are elements that will stop at nothing to give the election to their preferred candidate. So that's a recipe for maybe violence, for ruthlessness, for some of the weirder things that I postulate in the article. You know, you could see Republican state legislatures submit their own slate of delegates based on the election night count that is somehow different than what the governor or the secretary of state would put forward. That dynamic exists in places Florida.
Walk us through that a little bit, because the idea is that the Secretary of State certifies the election and then essentially awards the electors. But the legislature could theoretically overrule that.
They have the power to essentially retroactively change what the election, how the election is counted. In other words, say that take back control from the popular vote count and write a new law that says actually we, the legislature, have the control of determining where the electors go, and we can send in this slate of electors. Bush v. Gore in 2000 essentially said that was an allowable possibility. Now, their ruling about the continued counting in Florida foreclosed on that. But the Republican legislature in Florida was ready to send in their own slate of electors for George W. Bush in 2000. And the Supreme Court, in an aside, essentially said that would have been legal for them to do. As we know, state legislatures can determine how electoral votes are distributed, and most states do popular votes. Some states do it by election, congressional district. The winner of each district gets one electoral vote. But they could also say, "Well, we decide who the electors are, and we're going with the election night count." And then you could have a situation where a Secretary of State certifies one slate, and a state legislature certifies another, and you have these competing slates, and it's up to Congress at that point to figure out which slate to take. And of course, you're going to have, and this happens in the new Congress. That's one thing that's important. We don't know whether it will be a split Congress and Republicans control the Senate, Democrats control the House as they do right now. We actually don't know.
It's the new Congress
that will make the determination. That's correct.
I see. Let me throw one more mix into this. We keep referring to the United States Supreme Court. In that time, most legal observers were shocked that the U.S. Supreme Court took this case coming from Florida. It had already been litigated, or was being litigated, in the Florida State Supreme Court. Now, at that time, the Florida State Supreme Court was a left-leaning state Supreme Court. It is now a right-leaning. And in Wisconsin and in Michigan, these are very conservative state Supreme Courts. It's conceivable that if they're competing slates that the U.S. Supreme Court says we don't touch, or whatever goes on in these states, you would imagine, okay, we're going to go to the state Supreme Court. Well, that's not going to work out very well if it's a Democrat that is looking for some type of redress from the state Supreme Court in those states, Michigan, Wisconsin, which, you know, these are the states that we're talking about where something's going to go down. Yes. Pennsylvania is left-leaning state Supreme Court. But it's also, I can imagine, like, the U.S. Supreme Court deciding whether or not they take these any one of these cases is a function of how they perceive the court, the state Supreme Court, is going to rule on these. I mean, there's so many factors here. There's a lot of factors going through.
Yeah.
All right, keep telling us some more scenarios.
The other issue is there are deadlines, right? So states are supposed to report their results out by December 8th. Electors are supposed to be cast in the Electoral College, this sort of anachronistic situation where people cast on behalf of their state. That's supposed to happen on December 14th. And then the incoming Congress certifies the election on January 6th. If this fight continues throughout and there are disputes throughout, those deadlines could just be missed. And if you don't have a definitive set of electors and electoral votes, you could have a situation on January 6th where nobody has the 270 electoral votes that you need to win because the other states are held up either by court orders. I mean, this is one way that a Wisconsin or Florida Supreme Court, they could just say, well, we're continuing. I remand this to the lower court to figure out, and we just extend it out, and Joe Biden doesn't have 270, and Donald Trump doesn't have 270. Do you know what happens at that point? If you watch the fifth season of Veep, you would know the House of Representatives decides who becomes president, and
the next Congress.
That's correct.
Okay.
And they do it in such a way that each state delegation gets one vote. So right now, the split is 26 delegations are in the hands of Republicans, even though Democrats control the House. Democrats have 23, and Pennsylvania is tied. You could conceivably get a situation where if one seat flips to the Democrats in Florida, a net one seat, and that tie is broken in Pennsylvania, you'd have 25-25 between the House of Representatives, between Democrats and Republicans. So, I mean, the scenarios are insane, and sometimes, you know, you hear this around convention time, like this brokered convention. It's like a journalist fantasy. But I really think that the closer this election is, the more plausible these fantasy scenarios become.
Fantasy is not exactly what I would call it. I think you started your piece by saying horror
scenario,
story, and I think that is what it is. It's a nightmare scenario. Okay, so 25-25, is there – what happens in that instance? I didn't realize it was a state delegation thing. So in many respects, it's not.
Yeah.
It's not. Again, it's not a popular vote. It turns out to be like, I guess a gerrymandering issue.
California gets one vote despite, you know, 45 of its 53 members of the congressional delegation being Democratic gets the
what other
same
delegations?
Weighted vote as Wyoming.
What other delegations? What other delegations, David, are in that could flip? I mean, it's just sort of shocking to me that we're having this conversation.
But the ones that are closest to flipping are, I mean, Michigan. The only reason that's not tied is because Justin Amash went to become an independent, which gives Democrats the advantage. So that's effectively tied. So the outcome there in Michigan will be important. Pennsylvania and Florida are the other two big ones. Texas, the way that it's seemingly going, could actually flip. to be majority Democratic in its districts. So there are, I mean, the scenarios are kind of ridiculous in terms of what could happen there.
What happens if it's tied?
What if there's a tie? So the Senate, the House picks the president, the Senate picks the vice president. And the Senate might not have a tie. There might be a definitive vice president nominated. So on January 20th at 12 p.m., the president and vice president are sworn in. If there's no president to be sworn in, but a vice president is available to be sworn in, that person becomes the president. And if there are if there's neither, then the Speaker of the House becomes the president. So that's the line of succession.
So in the Senate, it's not obviously a function. It's not a function of delegations. It does. That's irrelevant, right? Because it's too.
You know, I'd have to look at that. I didn't really cover that aspect of it. I think it's just a vote by vote basis. So, but it certainly there are scenarios where it's a 50-50 tie. And Mike Pence would still be the tie-breaking vote in the Senate, even in the new Congress, until January 20th. So he could make himself president in that scenario.
These sound like, honestly, any other year that we had this conversation, if you had written this piece in any other of the, 30 years that I've been eligible plus that I've been able to vote, and I read this thing, I would be like, this lunatic, we're not going to interview.
Yeah,
this sounds crazy.
This is crazy.
This is like what we used to call like a slate piece, right? I just want to write something that's never going to happen, but it's an interesting thing to sit there and, contemplate. But
as these things go on, I think this is an important point, that as these things take place, the essential unfairness of the system will be broadcast on both sides, and that will lead to undeniably, and actually there are groups on the Democratic side I know that are already preparing for this, will lead to street action, will lead to mass protests, will lead to Belarusian types of actions in the streets that we've seen in countries around the world, various revolutions. If you have a scenario where a large percentage of the population believes that the election has been stolen, I mean, we didn't get to that level in 2000, although some would argue we should have.
Yep.
But I think the tensions are much more inflamed now. So, I mean, there's this group called the Transition Integrity Project that did these tabletop simulations of what would happen in various scenarios, various outcomes of the election. And the maybe the most interesting one to me was the situation where, much like Hillary Clinton, if Joe Biden wins the election by 3 million, 4 million, 10 million votes, but loses the Electoral College, and what would happen in that case? And in the one tabletop simulation where that was happening, the Democrats pushed to overturn certified results in states with Democratic governors. They refused to accept the election. And the guy who was in the simulation making that call was John Podesta, who was Bill Clinton chief of staff, Hillary Clinton campaign chair, a model of the establishment within the Democratic Party. And even he is saying, we will not accept that result, which was the same result as 2016 and the same result as 2000. So there is
how does a radicalization of this? Right. What can a governor do? A governor of what state? Of Wisconsin or California?
Well, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania have have they all have Democratic splits with regard to the legislature as opposed to the president. So we're talking about the competing slates of electors scenario.
Can the governor overrule? I mean, in these state constitutions in those states, can the governor overrule?
It varies from state to state. In some cases, it's the Secretary of State's call. A lot of this has been tightened up since 2000 because of exactly what happened in the 2000 race. But, you know, you look at a place like Michigan where Jocelyn Benson, a Democrat, is Secretary of State, and the legislature is hardcore Republican, and you could see some disputes that that are long lasting, and you would expect Democrats to pressure Benson to hold out. And in addition, there will be mass popular street actions. That will be, you know, you talk about the Brooks Brothers riot. There's going to be both sides here, I think, yep. In the event, if it's as bad as it could be in terms of the contested election.
So there are organizations, I mean, I presume you know more about what's happening, on the Democratic side than the Republican side in terms of, like, organizing around this.
There's a group called Protect the Results. So Protect the Results they are taking pledges for people to take action if Trump refuses to accept the results. Because, by the way, even if it looks like the election is pretty clear cut, Biden's ahead on election night in some of these states, and the margin just grows, and he has a path to 270. Do you really think Trump is going to accept the results?
Well, but that scenario to me seems not any less likely than the one that you've laid out, but that seems at least the most clear cut, right? Like, he decides he doesn't want to go. On a federal level, Bill Barr brings cases to the Supreme Court. But the state scenario that you're talking about, the stuff that happens in the states, right, outside of the national media, the stuff that happens in the counties, the stuff that happens in the Republican state legislatures, that's the scariest type of scenarios, it seems to me, because that is the
but a scenario where Bill Barr tries to shut down counts or say that certain counties must stop their counting. I mean, there are definitely, you know, anything that Bush's team did in 2000, just magnify that. And the Trump legal team has shown no compunction against the most outlandish kind of litigation arguments in order to, get their way. You have Bill Barr just this week stepping in on a defamation case.
Right.
That is a personal case. I don't think that there's anything that you could put past the possibility of Bill Barr is essentially the House lawyer for Donald Trump, and what he might do in this kind of situation. And I just want to just bring up one other point here, is that we're in the middle of a deadly pandemic. So, I mean, all of these.
Well,
things
that's
that
the
are
other thing. I like when you were talking about these street actions, I just thought, like, okay, I get a mental note. Got to get ready for these street actions. Oh, wait a second. It's going to be winter. It's going to be we could very well be either in the midst of or on the precipice of the peak of the second wave in the northern part of this country, particularly in places like Washington or New York, people are going to take to the streets. Maybe in like a Wisconsin or a Michigan or, you know, a Pennsylvania, where presumably we could be in the midst of the second peak, second wave, as it were. And it just boggles the mind.
Let me just address a couple things with that. Number one is the fear that the combination of coronavirus cases and flu season, which is a perennial will be extremely difficult for the health system to handle. So, I mean, the good news here is that the same social distancing techniques that prevent coronavirus also prevent the flu. And we've seen in other countries in the world, they've had dramatically lower flu seasons in their winters, which is our summer, because there has been social distancing in place.
Right.
The flip side to that is that we're not very good with social distancing, right? I mean, we have had a wave that no other developed country has had. And so you put those two together, it's difficult to diagnose. You might have people being treated for COVID when they have the flu and vice versa, and that could get very bad, especially the latter, because you're not isolating patients immediately. Could have difficulty with getting flu shots out if there's a more dangerous communicable disease going on at the same time. And then there's this whole issue of a COVID vaccine. And, you know, certainly there's the fear that Trump's going to announce something before the election. But the announcement is just the beginning of the process, which is the largest logistical process in the history of mankind. And you're dropping it in the middle of potentially an election chaos that's going on. You're talking about hundreds of millions, billions worldwide of doses being distributed. And a very intricate process, the likes of which we haven't tried to do in America at this scale, really ever. And you know, who decides what who gets it first? What does that process look like?
Right.
Is there corruption around that process? What is the implication for public health if something gets out that isn't actually ready for prime time and it causes issues like it did in the 1976 swine flu case, where vaccines right in October of 1976, mass amount of vaccines went out. Turned out swine flu wasn't that big a deal, and the vaccine gave hundreds of people paralysis, Julianne Barr syndrome. So that had an effect on flu vaccines for decades because people just shied away from them. And so there's a lingering health complication that you get if you put out a vaccine that's not ready, or if it's perceived as a political game that's being played with it,
right.
Or there's something untrustworthy about it. So it's incredibly dangerous to have this be the moment when we're doing that.
All right. So, David, if anybody is still listening at this point and they haven't gone into some type of apoplectic shock, because I'm holding on white knuckled at this point. People are going to hear this 6 weeks out from the election or so. What can people do? Are there organizations that that people can go and Google right now to support with money? Are there organizations or pledges that they can take to prepare? Are there ways in which they can tell their friends? What?
As the first thing, I think the first thing is, and the reason I wrote this, is that we have to be prepared for it. We have to know exactly what's coming down the pike. None of this should be surprising. I mean, it's all been telegraphed by President, by members of his administration, by his campaign, by allies. We know what's about to happen. And having that knowledge is helpful, so that then people can be educated that there's not going to be a vote that's going to be completed on election night, and that there are resources that are going to be needed to fight this out over the course of the month. It means maybe prioritizing early voting, so there isn't as much of a blue shift that plays into Trump's hands. It means bolstering. Having political leaders in these key battleground states, being pressured to let the election system do its job the way that it's supposed to be done. It means that preparing and steeling ourselves for the potential of street organization and street resistance to the most extreme possibilities. And we didn't talk about the transition, the relatively good scenario. which could be subject to a ton of sabotage by a lame duck president who's out for self-enrichment and self-protection. There are pardon scenarios, including one that I brought up where Trump pardons Pence and then resigns, and Pence pardons Trump like 10 minutes before inauguration day.
That's what Cohen anticipated.
Exactly.
Michael Cohen. Yeah,
I did write that before him. But there are all these scenarios, and we have to be worried about what happens in the transition. Not just the pardon stuff, but what the deliberate sabotage that could come about with respect to the virus, with respect to the vaccine, respect to not informing people of national security issues, all of these things that could happen in the handover of power that puts Biden in a worse position when he's starting, which will then play into a narrative that that Trump and his side will push. All of these things are I think foreknowledge is incredibly important. It's the reason that I put this together, just to try to lay it out so that people aren't surprised by any of this stuff, and forewarned is forearmed.
David Dayan, people can check out your piece, "The Winter of Our Discontent: Projecting the 78 Harrowing Days After the Election at the American Prospect." So I don't know if we have talked about a more important piece on this program in maybe in years. People need to go. Do exactly what David just said. Be aware of what could happen so that the next step is you start to take some action now and tell people you know. David, thank you so much for coming on. Really appreciate it.
All right. Thank you.
David Dayan is the executive editor of The American Prospect. His new book, Monopolized, Life in the Age of Corporate Power, is available now, and it's fantastic. Hey, that's it for this week's Ring of Fire Radio. A special thank you to all of our free podcast subscribers who decided this week that they cared about independent media and have decided to support this show by becoming members. We cannot thank you enough. You can go to rofpodcast.com right now to become a contributor and supporter of this program. We have left the firewall open, as it were, for everybody during this COVID era, but we still need your support. You can go to rofpodcast.com right now to do so. Don't forget to follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. Check out my daily show. It's called The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm for my daily live stream covering all the biggest news stories of the day. It's also available later as a podcast. And every morning, you can get 6 or 7 minutes worth of headlines completely free at amquickie.com or AM Quickie on Stitcher, iTunes, wherever your podcasts are served. Check that out. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.
My cold-hearted child, tell me how you feel. Just a rain in the morning air, dark shadow.